Welcome to Indie Radio Garden. This week's highlights from community radio in the Philadelphia region.
This program brings ordinary citizens to the air to discuss issues related to health, race, safety, workers' rights, and the will to survive in pandemic times.
The first clip comes from WHGE LP, 95.3 Afro-American Historical Society of Delaware. From the show Eastside Pride, Rochelle Wilson interviews Mr. Harmon Carey, founder and station manager of WHGE, about the neighborhood history.
You are the station manager, the first Black-owned, Black-operated, Black journalist news information network in the city of Wilmington. How did that happen?
Well, it happened not over anything that I did. In fact, when I was approached by a community activist named Liz Allen about 4 years ago to start this program, I told her that even though I had been a host of a talk show on WILM, I did not feel that I was equipped to manage a radio station. So I told her to get someone else to do it. She said, had already then told me that the FCC had opened up for licenses, to receive applications for licenses for low-powered radio stations. And her contacting me was to see if I would apply for a license. So I said, no, call someone else. I guess about a week later she called me and said, Harmon, no, I can't find anyone else to do it. You can do it. You can do it. And I said, well, I'll try. So I filled out the application after pulling it offline and submitted it to the FCC. And surprise of surprises, in their ranking system, I had scored and tied for the top score with a school, a private school in Wilmington named, it's really in Hokesson, named Sanford Prep. We both had gotten perfect scores, so the FCC gave us both notice that we should get together and decide how we were going to divide up the 24-hour day, broadcast day. So I called the headmaster. In public schools, it's the principal. In private school, they sometimes call their principal the headmaster. And I spoke with him, and he said that the staff member, the faculty member who had submitted the application, no longer worked at Sanford. So they were going to go forward with the project. So I asked if he could put that in writing, and he did. Now, the FCC had given us a deadline and had said, either you divide up the time, or if we don't hear from you by X date, we will do it. So when I got the copy of the letter from the headmaster, I sent it with a letter to the FCC, and I requested the entire 24 hours. And they got back and said, you got it. So here we are.
Awesome.
Put the first Black-owned and operated radio station in Wilmington, and we broadcast 24 hours.
And that within itself is history. And to me, the story that you just told really marks that this is what the ancestors wanted, because the way that they worked things out in favor of WHGE tells me that this is what is destined and supposed to be happening. Now, it's also a true fact that you are a historian with the Historical Society, but you grew up right here, is that correct? Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, I am a product of Wilmington's East Side. I was born here in this neighborhood on July the 7th, 1936. Our family lived at 420 East 5th Street here on the East Side. I went to elementary school and high school right here on the East Side. And I tell people that I haven't gone very far in life. I was born about four blocks from here. And that ain't very far. Well, 5th Street to 9th Street, yes, four blocks. I went to elementary school with five black, all-black elementary schools during the period of, during the time of segregation. Can't really remember the sequence, but I'll name the schools. And I went to these schools not only during the school year, but during the summer when they had a summer camp. Summer camp number five, the 13th and Walnut Street. Elementary school number 20 and number 29. Number 20 was at 10th and Kirkwood Streets, and number 29 at 12th and Poplar Streets. And then I went to Howard High School. In fact, anybody who went to high school who was black during these this time either went to Howard or they didn't go to high school.
Okay.
Because Howard was the only black high school for only black high school in the entire city and in the entire state.
So tell me, what was it like, you know, in those high school days? And I do know a little bit about Howard. It is historically black, which I believe now there's a lot more integration, of course. But back then, in the days of segregation, what was that like? All the black kids are at Howard and all the everyone else is somewhere else. So, you know, how did that work out?
Well, as I look back on it, I have come to realize that it just seemed to us at the time to be the normal state of affairs. This, we never felt any being upset about going to black school. We thought that's what we were supposed to do. So the idea of going to white school was a non-issue.
Right.
It was a we were doing what we were supposed to do.
Right.
Now, I sometimes wish, as I think back on my childhood and coming up through high school, that I had been more aware of the fact that I was going to a segregated school, but it didn't seem that way then. It was just doing the natural thing.
Right.
And as I've learned, you know, as after going to college and graduate school, et cetera, that I feel privileged to have gone to an all-black school, really, and having all-black teachers, because those teachers gave us love and the encouragement that we needed. And they saw in us, they saw in Harmon Carey more than I saw in myself. I wasn't going to college, I was going to be a barber. Now, nothing wrong with being a barber, but I, because I worked in a barber shop on the East Side at Eddie B's in the 400 block of East 10th Street. Nothing wrong with being a barber. It was the teachers who said, boy, you ought to go to college. And guess what I did?
Yeah, the encouragement. I think it's so important to have, especially black male teachers, to help with our young black male students. And it seems in so many of our schools, our high schools, junior high, elementaries, we've really lost, there's been a disconnect with that. We just don't have as many black male teachers applying. But would I be accurate if I said that the education, the level of education, was different then than it is now because of that connection with black male teachers?
The connection with black male teachers, you're absolutely correct. That meant a lot to me. I had, I can think of several of them by name. One was a William Branch. He came down from Philadelphia, taught French. I think he taught social studies. I had Mr. Young, William Young, who taught social studies, whose his family, he comes from a family of educators. His sister, Catherine Hazor, was an elementary school principal. Then there was a Mr. Gardner, who taught math and who taught geometry. And I think the most influential person for me was our music teacher. His name was Harry Andrews. Mr. Andrews came from Westchester, Pennsylvania, and I played in his band, and I sang in his choir and men's double, or they may have called it the boys' double quartet. I'm not sure about that. But he was so inspiring. He opened my eyes to a number of things. Those men were very, very, a very, very important part of my education.
Yeah. And so, again, during those times, it was very segregated. And so, obviously, you know, little black boys and little black girls, we went to different dances and we played at different parks and we went to different musical concerts than all the other nationalities that may have been in Wilmington at that time. What are some of the hip-hop places here for Eastside Pride? Where were we hanging out and what was going on here on the east side when we wanted to have a little extra fun?
Well, let me start off by responding to one of your earlier comments, and that is about the separation. We, in growing up, there was a playground, a public playground, at 5th and Pine Streets in Wilmington. Our family lived in the 400 block, so we were of 5th Street, and we were just a block and a half from that playground. But only the white kids could go to that playground. We went to the playground after the playground closed. When they locked the gates, then we climbed over the fence, and then we played softball, and we had fun on the swings and the sliding.
Did that board. Just seem like the normal thing then? Was that normal? Well, as normal as going to an all-black high school?
It just seemed like, yeah, for us at 8, 9, and 10 years old, you know, we didn't feel any anger about it. We were just doing what we were supposed to do, and there was a wading pool on the 4th Street side because of the playground. The playground went from 5th Street to 4th Street, and there were two levels. And the lower level was near 4th Street. And they had a wading pool that had a sprinkler, and we'd look at the white kids having fun in that wading pool and just wish that we could do it. The only time we could really come close to feeling the exhilaration that you feel when the water's coming down on you is when they closed and there was a thunderstorm, then we would have our bathing suits on and we would be down there. The sprinkler in the park would be off, but God's sprinkler would be on. Yeah.
The second piece of audio comes from 92.9 FM. WGGT-LP G-Town Radio. Kay Wood and Linda Rosenwine host the Planet Philadelphia show, where they interview Maurice Jones, general manager of PAR Recycle Works, which recycles electronic waste while employing and training individuals re-entering society after prison. He discusses the need for e-waste recycling, its methods, and combines the social justice issues of ex-prisoner rehabilitation with this work.
Hi, everyone. This is Kay Wood, the host of Planet Philadelphia. Linda Rosenwein, our assistant producer, is also here with me, and we're doing a Zoom call with Maurice Jones. And Maurice, hello. Thank you so much for speaking with us. You're the co-founder of something called PAR Electronic Recycling, or PAR Recycle Works.
That's correct. So PAR stands for People Advancing Reintegration, and we are a nonprofit electronics recycling company here in the city of Philadelphia.
So you're the co-founder, and I would love to find out more about you and why you decided to do this.
I want to say about 7 years ago, we started on this quest to find a business to serve individuals that were returning home from prison. We found that there's a challenge with individuals trying to find jobs and job training. And we saw many different things. And then we heard about a recycling company in Indianapolis doing just that, assisting individuals that are coming home from prison and recycling electronic waste. I never knew what electronic waste was, but we all have a bit of electronic waste, whether it's old phones, old cords, old laptops, old VCRs, old DVD players, old TVs, old ACs, old everything is what we recycle. I had no clue of what that was. And then we delved a bit deeper into it. And we saw that it's a stream of revenue that we could take part in by just deconstructing the things that we receive.
Maurice and I met a little while ago and set up this interview, and you mentioned a couple things then. And one was your mission to help returning citizens, but you were also, you talked very passionately about what a huge problem e-waste is.
So yeah, e-waste is actually one of the fastest growing waste systems that are out there. It's expected to go up about 500% in the next 10 years. Only about 15 to 20% of the e-waste is recycled. E-waste is an intentionally fueled entity by planned obsolescence and the planned obsolescence cycle. The rest of the e-waste that's not recycled goes into landfills and incinerators. The U.S. actually produces over 3 million tons of e-waste annually. So it's a huge problem here in and around the city.
Maybe you could tell us how one recycles some of the different types of e-waste.
What we see a lot of are like laptops and tablets and phones and old computer towers and servers and networking equipment. But the traditional consumer would have power cords, and in those power cords are copper. And so what we do is there's a machine that strips off the rubber tubing and gets to the copper. And that's one way that we do that. For computer towers, the computer towers are in a casing, and each computer tower is pretty much the same, no matter the brand. Inside it has a heat sink, which is aluminum. It has wire, which is copper. It has a motherboard, which is gold and gold plated. And an interesting fact with the motherboards is that there's more gold in a motherboard, in 1 ton of motherboards, than it is in 80 tons of gold ore that we pull from the earth. So we can use the recycled boards to build the processors now that they are limited for other manufacturing entities like cars and boats and et cetera. So this is something that can be used and reused once it's broken down to its original form.
Well, I also was wondering about some of the minerals that are in some of these devices, some of them rare earth minerals.
There's gold, there's platinum, there's palladium, there's rhodium that's in the process. These are in the processes of building a computer or a device. Every device that has an electrical current that does something when you press a button has this type of minerals that are in it. And we do a really bad job as a human race in taking care of our earth. This stuff is going to go into landfills, and it's going to become really harmful, especially old television. Old CRT televisions has mercury and lead in it. Old ACs, air conditioners, and refrigerators, they have freon that needs to be extracted. So this is an opportunity to create jobs, which we absolutely wanted to do. We want to create jobs. but also we need to save our planet for the next few generations, not just the next generation.
I wanted to also turn to the people side of it. How do you recruit your employees and how do you train them?
Our employees come from a myriad of referral sources, whether it's other nonprofit organizations that are doing workforce development work. They come from workforce development with the city, their Career Link. Individuals find out about us through job fairs, especially some that have taken place inside the jails. We've done some virtual job fairs. So individuals can go to one of these resources and they can connect with us directly through that. Also, we are always available on any of the social media outlets, so people can connect with us directly there. Our only requirement is someone that has been justice affected and or adjudicated. Where other employers will take on the least amount of people, we're looking to hire the most amount of people in order to get them trained up for and facilitate further employment. We put individuals on a path to self-sufficiency with our job and job training that significantly decreases the chances for individuals to go back or to reoffend. Since 2015, we've helped 100 individuals. Most have received full-time work or mainstream jobs. Less than 5% have reoffended or gone back to prison. And the national four-year recidivism rate is 65%. So we're really, really bucking that system by using our job training for individuals that are looking to change their lives. This is something that most have never been introduced into the world of electronics and or electronics recycling. This is something that is new and it's a change. However, the skill sets that are produced here, it's warehouse work, shipping and receiving, customer service. These are things that are ingrained in each individual as they're here so they can go on to further employment. And we teach some of the non-traditional things, maybe some of the things that we've learned from osmosis through our parents or through our caretakers, like going to work, showing up on time, things that people take for granted. Professionalism. Those are things that people take for granted. And we want to make sure that we are training our individuals up for success. Also, what I've learned in most of the Department of Correction institutions in Pennsylvania, there isn't a reentry office that is serving the individuals. So you have a myriad of people coming from different locations that are housed in an entity and aren't being set up for success when they're. So they're just going through their time without a plan for reentry. So once an individual gets introduced to us, they'll send us a letter. And once they send us the letter, then we'll respond back to them and we'll start to begin that training and assist them for reentry as they're coming back.
So it's not a permanent job. It's a job for preparation for other jobs.
So we are a transitional employer, whereas there are other traditional employers like a supermarket that looks to hold on to individuals long term. We look to train individuals anywhere between 3 and 6 months. And so in that 3 and 6 month time frame, they work with us for about 24 to 35 hours per week. And then we can then recommend them and refer them to other employment opportunities with our vetted employer partner.
Could you tell us some of those employer partners?
So you have GoPuff, which is a local delivery service. You have Crust Vegan Bakery, which is a woman-owned bakery here in Mania. You have Temple, you have the City of Philadelphia. SD Richmond are some of the few that we have.
Because I'd like people to use your service and feel safe doing it, how do the people who want you to pick up stuff for recycling know that they can feel safe with individuals who've come out of prison coming to the house?
That's a really, really good question. So everyone is bonded that comes in. That's one of the first levels of assurance that we can take. With a federally bonded up to $30,000 for every individual. So that's one step. But every individual here is taking a step to change their life. And that's the assurity that we can give to each individual, where we've never had, I mean, in our 5 years, knock on wood, we've never had any instances of a person going to someone's house and there's been any challenges interpersonally with that individual. So I'm going to say our program is working because there's some mentoring going on how one should act and behave when dealing with the public. So that's happening on a weekly basis. We have a job coach and professional coach that comes in and is training up individuals for that next step in their lives and in their career path. So there's some other ways we can work together. They can drop off their electronics at our warehouse at 2024 West Hunting Park. They can organize a community event. We can come and we can set up a time and people can bring their stuff to us direct. We've done this a lot. The community events, we've done a lot with townships, universities, school districts, and that's who we work with. And every donation, every contribution is a tax-deductible contribution because we are a 501c3 nonprofit organization.
It sounds like you're asking for an awful lot of electronics. And you have this transitional workforce. How does that all come together?
To recycle the electronics, it's laborious. I mean, it has been put together by hand in most cases. And to get to the viable metals and viable non-ferrous metals that are in there, we have to extract them. And so we need more electronics so we can serve more people, so we can generate more revenue to serve more people. We absolutely need more material in order to hire more
people. Linda mentioned a very good point about people feeling secure giving their laptops or their old computers to be recycled. And how is that handled?
So we are a certified RIOS and R2 recycler, which is RIOS is Recycling Industry Operating Standard. So we are certified by them, and R2 is the responsible recycler. We take the boots and suspenders approach with people's data. Any data containing material is instantly destroyed. It's called a degausser. It's an electronic magnet. That's the first step. Then the data containing material, there's a hole that's driven through it, and then it's shredded. So we take the boots and suspenders approach. And that's the level that the NSA takes with destroying data.
Where do you operate?
We are at 20th and Hunting Park.
Yeah, but you go out to locations to pick up stuff. And how far would you?
I mean, we go as far north as Massachusetts, as far south as Georgia. So, you know, and as far west as Kentucky. So we go as where there's a need, and whenever there's a need and a large enough amount for us to go get it, we'll go get it.
People are listening to this and they want to find out more. How would they do that?
They can go to our website, par-recycleworks.org, and that's RecycleWorks with an S. Or they can follow us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, YouTube. They can come out to any of our events and talk to any of our staff. That's absolutely another way. We are connected with the Philadelphia Library. If someone wants to refer someone for employment, or you can contact us through our email at info@par-recycleworks.org.
Is there anything else that you would want the listeners to hear?
Yeah, actually, I think that there's one other thing that I would like to touch on, and that's more about the people. I think that individuals that are returning from prison need an opportunity, and that's what PAR creates. It's just an opportunity to change one's life with dignity and humanity. And I think highlighting the individuals that want to change and want to have a do-over, I think that everybody that has breath can change, and this is their opportunity.
Thank you so much for talking with us today.
No problem. I appreciate, and I'm extremely humbled to be a part of it. Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us. My name is David Juro. I'm the host of Neighborly Chats at WRGU-LP, Germantown United CDC. Indie Radio Garden is a Prometheus Radio Project production.